From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thanks for being with us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. It has been a heavy week in the news here and around the country. It opened, of course, with the deadliest mass shooting in modern American history in Las Vegas. It just so happened that months ago, we booked an interview with Jeremy Richmond. He's the father of one of the 20 children killed in the Sandy Hook school shooting in 2012. His daughter, Avielle, was 6 years old.
I read a portion of the biography of his daughter. They created a foundation named for her, the Avielle Foundation. You can check it out at aviellefoundation.org. Really cool stuff they're doing, looking at research in the brain, trying to predict when someone might turn violent, maybe head off violence in the future. And there's a biography for his daughter there. I read a portion of that on the program, and it made me emotional. Jeremy's response to seeing my emotion was a powerful point that resonated with our listeners. Here it is.
Two things that are really poignant to point out. When Jennifer and I created this foundation, you know, what we can talk about why we went in this direction, two things became really quickly evident. One was that it was a huge unmet need, that nobody really thought of reframing the way that we picture violence as a disease that could be studied. But completely unrelated to that, and why I'm bringing this up now, is that people would become overwhelmed with emotion and express the sentiment very commonly, I can't imagine. I can't imagine what you're going through. And while we certainly appreciate the sentiment, the irony is that when they're shedding a tear, when they're touching their forehead and bowing their head for a second, ironically, when they're saying, I can't imagine, they are imagining it. And the more we thought about it, the more we realized that it's the imagination that we need. It is that connection. It's allowing ourselves to be touched, to get emotional unapologetically. That is the empathy that we need. Because if we don't do that, then if we don't allow ourselves to open up and be touched by somebody else's story, somebody else's experience, then we're not motivated to get engaged and to change things. And as we realize that there's a great quote from a gentleman, A.J. Heschel, that says, few are guilty, but all are responsible. And I really think that that's an important aspect of life in general, to recognize that you're part of this whole giant puzzle. And if you don't imagine, if you don't let something touch you in the heart and put yourself in those shoes just for a few minutes, then you're failing and you're not playing the role as a community member, as a citizen, as a human that you need to. So we've developed the trademark, you can imagine, and that is our trademark. And on the brighter side of that imagination tunnel, it's the imagination that sets us free to paint the world brighter and more beautiful tomorrow than it is today. And I would go as far as to argue it's the imagination that actually, the capacity for imagination that we have, that makes us uniquely human.
You are a parent, and often people invoke families and parents and they say, this is too soon to talk about this. Can't talk about it right now. Now is not the time. Do you buy those kind of arguments?
You mean to
talk about what we do about this, you know, we need some time. We can't talk about it the next day or the next day or the next day, that we need some time to process, that it's too emotional and that it is too much emotion to discuss what can be done, and that inevitably it's intractable, and that we don't want to just speak from emotion. You know, sometimes I feel like that shuts down the conversation.
There is something to be said that, you know, for not having a knee-jerk response mm-hmm. to things, absolutely. But it's that passion that we need to really channel to doing something productive. So absolutely not. If you are feeling impassioned, sad, angry, without a doubt, we need to share that and use that common experience. That is what connects us, the common experience, to everybody else. So I would encourage you to sit down, talk with your family members, talk with your neighbors, your friends, your communities, and say, you know, this touches me. I'm sure it does you. What can we do? Let's do something. Let's take some action. Let's use this passion, focus it, and create compassion.
Next, we talk to Debbie Irving, a woman who describes herself as a typical country club kid growing up. She was raised in a wealthy suburb of Boston, mostly white, and in 2009, she took a class that explored her own racial identity. She says that class changed everything for her.
She wrote a book called Waking Up White. She's coming to Rochester later this month to discuss white advantage and how our society has been structured to preserve power for elites. In our interview, I asked about an interaction she had at a conference that she describes in her book. Here was this conference, and you end up having lunch, and you sit down, and in one of your table mates, you had a chance to talk to a man named Henry. And I believe, if I remember correctly, Henry was an African-American?
Yeah.
Okay, a person of color. And so let me just read from the book here. All right, here we are. So you said you wanted to break the ice. So, Henry, what do you do for work in Chicago? The conversation went on from there. We chatted with Henry and the assortment of other people who eventually filled our table. I thought it had been a lunch without incident. As we walked away, Barbara said to me, "Do you remember how you asked Henry right off the bat what he did for work?" Uh-oh, I thought. Yes, I said. Well, that's one of those things I've learned can drive people of color crazy. I felt dumbstruck. Not only had I never heard this, but I couldn't imagine how that could possibly be offensive. It was a standard first question at a professional conference, isn't it? What? I stopped in my tracks. Why? I know. Barbara put her hand on my arm and shook her head. I know. This is why it's so tricky. It's the first question you ask in a white setting, right? What do you do for a living? Yes. And I pictured my own father, my uncles, and my white coworkers greeting each other with a hearty handshake and a, "So what do you do, Tim?" If there were a top 10 list of icebreaker questions in my world, this would be on it. Well, Barbara explained, for people of color, it can easily be felt as you questioning someone's credentials. And frankly, most cultures around the world don't rank what you do for work as a hot topic of conversation. The glorification of professional status is a white culture thing. All right, Debbie, so there's that interaction. And some of our readers might say, are you being overly self-critical to feel badly about that? That's just normal, asking people what they do for a living. Or did you really take what Barbara said and did you think, well, I've only been seeing this from sort of a white perspective? I mean, tell me a little bit more about how you felt about that.
Well, my first reaction was to be really pissed off at Barbara. Like, Jesus, you're watching me like a hawk. How dare you? And who cares about that? That's so minor. I have learned that when I hear these words emerge from my own mind, it's a red flag. Here are the words. That's ridiculous. To this day, when I hear someone tell me something and I hear my mind say, that's ridiculous, I now know to say, whoops, someone's challenging your belief system and you have a choice here. You can judge the person who just told you and judge the idea, or you can consider it long enough to take it in. Maybe it's true. It requires suspending your own reality. It requires that I suspend my own reality long enough to at least consider what someone is saying. So that's a real skill that I'm still developing, however many years later, 9 years later. It's getting easier. But in that moment, I just wanted to, you know, soccer. I was like, I just had a nice lunch. I'm having a good time here. Like, why would you point that out? And how do you even know? I can tell you now, I'm 100% sure that's a real thing. So there's this whole body of work called microaggressions, which is about seemingly small to white people moments like that, where white people will do something that's absolutely normalized in white spaces that's just so annoying and or seriously hurtful in racially mixed spaces. So let me do this to explain what a microaggression is. Imagine that you're a young couple and you're trying so hard. You want to get pregnant, but you're suffering terribly from infertility. You don't share this with everyone. This is a really painful thing that you as a young couple are experiencing. Yet when you go into social settings, people are like, when's that baby coming along? Or maybe it's a person who is heterosexual and they haven't come out. They don't plan to come out and share it with everybody, but every time they're in a social setting, so have you met that special lady yet? Have you met that special man? So these are all typical questions. The first, normalizing having a baby without incident, and the second, normalizing heterosexuality. So there are things that are built into our ways of being socially that assume that kind of conversation isn't going to have a negative impact, but it can. So on the racial front, there's a whole host of things that people say, and I hear them all over the country, all across ages, and that what do you do for work is so annoying.
Now let's turn to the automobile, specifically life without one. We hear a lot about walkable cities and the desire to create communities that don't need cars. Millennials especially are driving less, but how about giving up cars entirely? Could you do it? What would it take?
Well, Sarah Jenks is a millennial who decided to give up her car 2 years ago, or more than 2 years ago, when she moved back to Rochester. One of our listeners said that giving up a car is akin to giving up our freedom. Here's what Sarah said about that.
So I feel pretty free. I do own a bike, and I usually ride my own bike, but I love this idea of options, and I'm not locked into any one form of transportation, and that's what makes a good transit system good. It's not just one can't just take the bus or a bike or walk. They can choose from any of these options what fits them at any given time. And I actually, like, I still, like, if I have to get to, say, I went to a wedding in Rockport, Mass last year, and that's not accessible, or it's accessible by MBTA, actually. Whoops. But I rented a car to get there. And, like, that's just one of my many options. A friend who lives in D.C. just told me about this new, it's like Airbnb for cars. You just rent somebody's car to, you know, go to IKEA or something. And I just love having all these options. I actually feel pretty free that way. I take trains and buses a lot of places. I think people would be surprised the small towns that like Greyhound and other independent bus lines go to. So I feel pretty free. I can take road trips.
Sarah has a story to share when it comes to what employers think, though, because I saw Sarah again at this event last week from Reconnect Rochester looking at how transportation and poverty intersect. And, you know, Sarah is someone who's fortunate that that doesn't touch her life in the same way it did in the people in the film. I thought the film was extraordinary. You agree?
Yeah, the film was great. I'd love if everyone listening could get their hands on it and see it.
And you can. It's available online. It's half an hour, and it will make you a better person. If you watch this film, I promise you, you will have a better understanding of just how difficult it is if you don't own a car because you can't afford it, but you are really dedicated trying to get out of poverty, but you're dealing with the transit system. It is a remarkable film, and we'll post a link online for you to check it out. Now, that's not necessarily your experience, but you still have to deal with employers who might say, wait a second, how did you get here today for this interview? And tell our listeners a story about that.
Yeah, so about, I think it was 2 weeks ago, I went in for a job interview, something I was super qualified for and had been really killing it in the interview process. I gave a great presentation on the topic, and then the interview really went sour when the program manager kept on talking about my lack of owning a car. In the job description, it requested that the candidate have a New York State driver's license and reliable transportation, and I consider myself to have both. I just don't own a car. And she kept on providing all these scenarios, really nitpicky about, like, oh, well, you know, you got to go to a training in Syracuse. How are you going to get there? And I said, well, Amtrak and then a cab or, you know, a bus and these things that are just, it's not even that I, like, make it work. It's just my life, and it's just another way of doing things. But I think it's hard for people in Rochester or in other similar car-centric societies to imagine that someone can really thrive and do a job really well without a car.
Just seemed like it was hard for her to get her head around it, huh?
Yeah, and I think it's just like with any other thing, when you're provided with a completely different perspective, it's hard to imagine at first that this thing could be real and good even. So hopefully employers in Rochester change that, because I do see it in a lot of job descriptions, must have reliable transportation, and like I said, I do have that, but they only think of it as a car, even though it might not even be as necessary to the job as they consider it to be.
And now think about the people in poverty who don't own a car, can't afford a car, and are being told you got to have reliable transportation. We are cutting out big portions of our society before they even get a chance to get in the door, and that's part of what that film is about.
Yeah, absolutely. So the film was about people who have to take, you know, like multiple buses to get to work, and they have to go, you know, really far. I luckily don't have that. When I was working at a specific location, it was just one simple bus ride. Tons of buses go from downtown to Strong. But I know that a lot of people come, you know, Strong, actually. So there are tons of people who live all over the city, and they might have to come from, you know, way up in Northeast or in Charlotte. And that's a really long bus and an added transfer. And in the RTS system, we don't have free transfers, so that's two bus fares right there just to get to work and two bus fares back.
Let's close the week with a little music. We lost rock legend Tom Petty on Monday. He died at the age of 66. If you know Tom Petty's music, songs like Free Fallin', Refugee, and American Girl, maybe you'll agree with some critics who acclaim Petty for his rootsiness, even though he performed in sold-out arenas. Well, we heard from a caller named Stephanie who wanted to talk about Tom Petty's songwriting. She says she takes issue with people who call it effortless. You'll hear from her about the challenges of songwriting, and then you'll hear our panelists. Sarah Hart's a Tom Petty fan, Sabi Reyes Kulkarni is a music journalist, and then you'll hear Dave Drago, a music studio owner and producer. Here's the caller, Stephanie.
The thing that I take umbrage with is this comment of effortlessness. It takes so much work as a songwriter to really work within the confines of kind of a classic structure of a song and make sure that it doesn't end up sounding trite or canned. And the fact that he did that for decades is, you know, a monumental, comment on his skill and craftsmanship. But like, you know, and I know that effortlessness is more of a feeling, and it does feel effortless. But as a songwriter, I give him so much credit for how perfectly he constructed his songs. I guess that's all I wanted to say.
Stephanie, I think you've got a lot of agreement here, and I think that's a great point. In fact, thanks for the phone call. Let's listen just for a second, because we can. So, you know, in the world of verse-chorus, verse-bridge-chorus, or verse-pre-chorus-chorus, that, you know, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers didn't change that model very much. And so when we talk about effortlessness, they didn't change the model. They weren't revolutionaries in that way. But I think Stephanie's point is appreciate that within that framework, damn, they were good. Yeah. And they made it feel effortless, but there was probably a ton of work. The first person wanted to jump, I think, Sarah, you wanted to say something to that. Go ahead.
Yes, what Stephanie was saying about working very hard to make sure that a song didn't sound trite or there was that song, You Wreck Me. They had that song sitting around for years because it used to be You Rock Me. And it just didn't sound right until they changed it to You Wreck Me.
It's a huge change. That's a great story.
It's like Letterman came along and elevated that song to something even higher than what it already would have been.
Wow, yeah, that's a great story and a great point. Because they could have just put it out there sort of haphazardly or knowing that it wasn't quite to their standard.
The tiniest change, and it
story.
Had to sit around for years waiting.
Yeah, Sabi, what do you make of Stephanie's comments?
Well, I wanted to piggyback off of them because Tom Petty himself, towards the end of his life in 2014, so 3 years ago, he did a Canadian interview, and he talked about how much effort goes into writing 11 songs that he considers, and that the band would consider all past muster and would flow together where it didn't feel like the album was dipping. And he said, look, if it takes me years to do that, and he said, I think it'll even take me longer the next time. Of course, he didn't have a next time, but... that just goes to show how much concentration went into it. And he said for him, a lot of times it was kind of not a struggle, but it took a lot of elbow grease. And that sometimes things would come to him very quickly, but other times it was just you kind of just slog through it. So again, the image of somebody, you know, like a master carpenter or something, the chair or the dining room table that you end up sitting at that looks totally smooth and is unassuming as it sits in the room actually took a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to get it to that stage.
Hmm. Dave, thoughts on this subject?
Yeah, the term effortless is a sound. It's a feel. It's not saying that anybody in his organization was not taking what they were doing seriously. It is super hard, like Stephanie said, to craft a song within sort of the pop song narrative, that flow that sort of the Beatles really brought to the table, and a lot of music from the 50s and the 60s brought to the table. It's really hard to fit real feelings, real ideas into that little like structure.
Yeah. And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, that's funny, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
One take. We're also on the WXXI mobile app. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, everybody. He's Evan. I'm Megan. We will talk to you Monday.